May it please the court. The facts of this case have been set out in the briefs, but in terms of highlighting them for your honors, this was a fatal motor vehicle collision that occurred back in February of 2010, and the plaintiff, one of the plaintiffs that I represent, was in the course and scope of his employment at the time of this fatal collision. This case involves the interplay between workers' comp insurance and employer-paid uninsured motorist coverage. We submit to you that the decision of the court below is erroneous for a number of reasons set forth in our briefs, and I just want to highlight a few of those for you.
But it all comes down to the interpretation of a statute, correct?
Your Honor, I think it does, but I also think it comes down to contract provisions.
Well, if the statute conflicts with the contract provision, the statute prevails, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, based upon...
in the rule in every case, that at least since I've been practicing.
I think that that's true, except for the fact that this court has routinely held that if there is a statutory provision, like in the case involving the mandatory arbitration provision that had to deal with uninsured motorist coverage, the right to trial by jury, and the policy said that the claim is going to be handled via binding arbitration.
I'm sorry.
That there was no right to trial by jury, Your Honor.
You punctuated your sentence with so many words that I don't know where you're going. Well, either the statute governs in case of a conflict with a contract provision or it doesn't.
Well, Your Honor, I think in this case, if the court does agree that the statute governs, the plaintiff still prevails because the statute was changed in 1993.
Okay. Can you help me understand that? Because I realize what the footnote says, but what were the exact changes to 2363E under the 1993 amendment that are relevant to this case?
What are relevant to this case, Your Honor, is I believe back in 1993, the court...
The legislature
made a determination. There were problems with whether or not uninsured or PIP coverage paid first or workers' compensation coverage paid first, and there was a problem with that. And the reason why that statute was changed to clarify that specifically after.
So that doesn't address underinsured motorists.
Well, Your Honor, I think it does, because if the court looks at what was added to that statute in 1993, after the except that talks about 2118 Title 21, it says reimbursement shall be had only from the third-party liability insurance carrier and shall be limited to the maximum amounts of the third party's liability insurance coverage available for the injured party after that claim has been settled or resolved. And the significance of that is, as the court noted in Hearst, that the right to subrogation by a workers' compensation carrier in employer-paid workers' compensation benefits and uninsured motorist coverage benefits, that statute provision now has essentially abrogated that right. And that's what the court said in Hearst. And I think the reason why that's...
Well, let's put Hearst to one side for a
yes,
moment.
Yes, sir.
Can you make an argument from the text of the statute that gets you to where you're telling us we have to go?
Well,
I don't see it.
Under Section 2363E, there is a discussion about the subrogation rights. And when the court looked at the pre-1993 statute,
Just tell me what part.
After the word "except," Your Honor.
Yes.
In the bottom portion of that.
Yes.
It says, it says reimbursement shall only be had from the third-party liability insurer, and they're talking about reimbursing the workers' compensation lien, and shall be limited to the maximum amounts of that third-party liability insurer's coverage available.
But isn't that modified by the rest of the language after "except that," specifically? Items of expense which are precluded from being introduced into evidence at trial by Section 2118.
Oh, Your Honor, I don't believe that that's the way it was intended. I don't believe that that's the way it was written, and I don't believe that that's the way.
Well, it is the way it's written.
Well, Your Honor, in the Hearst case, it was clear that in that footnote, it was acknowledged that this language basically eliminated the employer's right to subrogate workers' compensation benefits via employer-paid UM coverage.
Well, then what does that language mean? What is intended by that language after the word?
Well, I think, Your Honor, this is an exception in terms of the statute, and I think if it said all insurance policies available, if it said additional potential coverages that may apply to the insured, I think that would support the court's position in terms of these questions. But it specifically says reimbursement is only going to be from the third-party liability insurer and shall be limited to the maximum amounts of their coverage. So to give the court a hypothetical, let's suppose that my client had damages over and above the liability coverage and also had workers' comp. And let's say we had a recovery directly against the tortfeasor after the over and above the liability insurance coverage. Could the workers' comp carrier then subrogate directly against the tortfeasor over and above what the liability coverage said? Not based on the terms of the statute, Your Honor.
To get us from where this initial language is to where you are, is there something in the synopsis to the legislation that I'm missing?
Your Honor, I've looked for that, and I do have a copy of the 1993 statute, and it doesn't specifically address that as far as I'm aware in the synopsis of the bill.
So basically, your argument would have to derive from the text of 2363E?
And what's not added to the statute, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. One of the problems is that that 2363E says explicitly any recovery against the third party for damages resulting from personal injuries or death only after deducting expenses of recovery shall first reimburse the employer or its workers' comp insurance carrier for any amounts paid or payable under the Workers' Compensation Act. That's clear.
That's clear, Your Honor.
And then your argument is, or has to be, that what is given by that sentence is taken away by the except clause. Correct?
In addition to that, Your Honor, yes, sir.
How? I mean, you know, how is that a sensible construction of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I believe because of my argument that I just made that the uninsured motorist carrier is not specifically listed here. There's no indication that this applies to other potential coverages that either my client paid for or if the employer paid for. And if the court reads that statute the right way based upon your argument, the Adams versus Delmarva decision, which clearly allows a limitation on subrogation with employee paid uninsured motorist coverage versus
which is workers. Not this case.
I agree it's not this case, Your Honor. But I think that in terms of the damages, it really doesn't make a difference because of the fact that, as I started to say initially, the language of the contract, which clearly was the only case that decided.
The language of the contract doesn't matter if it's contrary to the statute. At least that's what I thought the law was, you're going to contend otherwise.
And Your Honor, I agree with that, except for then how does the court reconcile the Adams decision that had that language in it? It's the only decision that this court has ever involved that had the exact same statutory language or the exact same policy language that this case has that said that the workers' comp carrier does not benefit from the payment of uninsured motorist benefits. This statutory language was in existence at the time that Adams was decided. And if the court reaches the conclusion that Adams was correctly decided, we submit that the court also needs to reach the conclusion that the decision in this case needs to be reversed.
But the decision in this case makes a very bright line distinction between policies that are, you know, basically acquired or bought by the insured, in other words, by the plaintiff, employee, and those that are bought and paid for by the employer for the benefit of the employee.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that, in the Adams case, and in the Harris case that was decided before Adams, that was employer-paid coverage. There was no argument about that policy provision set forth that existed in the Adams decision.
Well, the trial judge made a distinction between employer-paid versus employee-purchased insurance.
Yes, sir.
What's wrong with that as a matter of policy or the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it is erroneous for a number of reasons, and a lot of the reasons are set forth in our review of cases from other jurisdictions. And in our brief, we cited these other distinctions. For example, the uninsured motorist coverage should be obligated to be paid because even though the employee didn't contract for the coverage, why should the workers' comp carrier be the beneficiary of that coverage? In other words, they want a reduction in what they are essentially asking to pay. My client is not getting fully compensated because her husband was killed, and there clearly is a reduction in the amount of her damages, and it remains a contractual liability whether the employee pays or the employer pays because of the fact that they're not a beneficiary of this particular agreement. The workers' comp carrier is not a beneficiary of the agreement between employer who paid the premium and the employee who's accepting or trying to accept the coverage. And why should the employer get the benefit of that when the coverages are for separate purposes, premiums are paid for separate bases, and
well,
there are...
Maybe perhaps it does impact the premium, could it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that, and I'm sure my opponent will tell you that it does, but in this particular case, these cases are fairly rare. The reason why this is an important issue is because of the significance of the injuries here, the amount of the premium, and the fact that my client is really entitled to ongoing death benefits until she remarries or until she passes away. And the risk is different, Your Honor. If the court looks at the risk for uninsured motorist coverage versus the risk that's attempted to be insured for workers' compensation coverage, the risk is different. Payment.
Let me start with some basics. Was the employer required to purchase underinsured insurance?
In our state, as the court is aware, you're required to offer coverage up to the limits of the liability coverage. And in this particular case, Philadelphia Insurance decided to purchase a significant amount of coverage with the thought, I suppose, to protect their employees when they're on the road.
You mean Connections?
Connections, yeah, but Philadelphia's the carrier, Your Honor.
They did not have to purchase
that. That is correct, Your Honor, but they chose to do that. They paid for that coverage, the workers' comp carrier now seems to be attempting to get a windfall for the fact that this happened to be employer-paid coverage as opposed to employee-paid coverage. And if the court looks at the cases from other jurisdictions, it doesn't make that much of a difference who paid for it. And I think recognizing how the policy of uninsured motorist coverage has evolved since the Harris decision back in the 80s, many of these cases talk about the strong public policy in favor of innocent.
Well, before you get onto that,
yes,
just to follow up on Justice Ridgely's line of questions, there is an economic difference. I mean, you seem to be arguing that the detriment, the economic detriment to the injured plaintiff is the same, regardless of who paid for the underinsured or the uninsured coverage, correct?
Well, except in this case, Your Honor, my client is not being permitted, based upon the lower court decision, to recover.
I'm not talking about in this case. I'm just talking generally. Your argument is that it doesn't matter who pays for that coverage, which wasn't required,
correct.
It still comes out of the pocket of the plaintiff, the party entitled to the ultimate recovery.
Or it comes out of the plaintiff's employer, who the plaintiff, in this case, Mr. Sternfeld, worked for, and presumably it was a valued employee, and we don't know the rationale behind buying $1 million worth of uninsured motorist coverage, but...
I'm not sure that's responsive to my question.
I apologize, sir.
The employer here is offering uninsured, is it uninsured or underinsured?
It's on in this case. Mr.
Okay,
Bedes had no coverage.
Coverage. that the employee would otherwise not have.
That's correct.
And to the extent the employers or the workers' comp insurers seeking a lien against the amount that's covered under the uninsured coverage, that's an amount that would not have gone, would not necessarily have been available at all.
Well,
to the plaintiff.
That's true, Your Honor, except for Mr. Sternfels was in the employer's vehicle at the time. And in terms of the risk, this employer, when it purchased that coverage, obviously knew it was insuring a risk, and that risk applied whenever he was in that vehicle or not. If he was in his own personal vehicle, that risk may be different. And I think that that's the reason for its basis to put it on them.
You're into your rebuttal time. If you'd like to save it, you can save it or continue.
I would like to save it, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. My name is Dan McKenney, and I'm here on behalf of National Union Fire Insurance Company. With me at council table is my associate, Catherine Hemming. I would like to begin with something that opposing counsel said. He said these cases are rare. They're not rare. There are a couple of these cases in my office, and Bill Caddy, who represented Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company, started off his thwarted motion for re-argument in front of the court by reminding the court that the reason he filed for a motion for re-argument when he had no standing to do so was the court's opinion, and he referenced the number of cases in his office that these issues concern. So they're not rare cases.
You help me out here by explaining what the footnote in the Hearst decision means.
I'll do my best. Hearst, as you know, Your Honor, was a case that did not involve workers' compensation issues. It involved the calculation of damages in underinsured motorist policies and the stacking of underinsured motorist policies. I read Hearst over and over and over again trying to find a place where that footnote would be applicable. I couldn't find it. It seems to simply exist there.
Okay, but it seems as if the court was trying to make a point about a change in the law as the result of a modification to Section 2363 that had taken place very shortly before this decision.
That's correct.
Is that footnote inaccurate?
I believe it is.
What is the basis for your saying that?
The basis is that the 1993 amendment to 2363E says and clarifies the issue where a workers' compensation carrier pays benefits that are otherwise payable by no-fault insurance. The workers' compensation carrier has a lien against the plaintiff's recovery against the tortfeasor. But those monies are never getting into evidence in that case. They're precluded. So the amendment tells the workers' compensation carrier, for the benefits you paid, wages or medical bills, that were otherwise PIP payable, you can't include them as a lien against the plaintiff's recovery against the tortfeasor. That's not fair because the plaintiff can't put that amount of money in. You have to go directly to the tortfeasor's liability insurance carrier for those monies, and after the case is adjudicated or otherwise settled, if there's any money, then you get that. It makes a very distinct difference, and I can tell you in my practice, I've done it many times, where I'm protecting the interests of the workers' compensation insurance carrier, and we have benefits that were paid but could have been paid under PIP. For those benefits, we file a separate lawsuit against the liability insurance carrier. Generally, what the trial courts do is they consolidate those cases for discovery purposes, and then if trial comes, my case gets peeled off, and the plaintiff tries his or her case against the tortfeasor.
So then aren't you agreeing that the decision below was incorrect?
The footnote?
No, the footnote says that you can only go after the third party, right?
For one area of damages only. It does not at all talk about the overall right of the workers' compensation carrier to assert a lien recovery.
If you're going to assert a lien, you have to assert a lien against something. And what I thought you were saying is that you can't assert a lien against any recovery by the tortfeasor. That is against the pot of money that the tortfeasor, the amount of the judgment in favor of the tortfeasor.
Only for one.
File, excuse me.
I'm sorry.
A separate action for a judgment against the liability insurer. Did I get that wrong?
Only for a small amount of what the comp insurance, the workers' compensation insurance carrier would be paying to the insured. It's only a small subset of benefits that would fall into the category.
So is it your position that the footnote would be correct if it said this? We note that the General Assembly has eliminated the ability of an employer's workman's compensation carrier to assert a priority lien against an injured employee's right to payment pursuant to the employer's uninsured motorist coverage for amounts payable under PIP. Would it then be correct? Is that what your position is?
Yes.
Or to put it
differently, I think so, yes.
You're saying there is a right to a lien, but the amount of that lien would have to carve out the PIP component?
Yes, under the theory that the workers' compensation carrier can't assert a lien against plaintiff's recovery for that small amount of damages that the plaintiff wouldn't have been able to put into evidence and allege against the tortfeasor. But otherwise, non-PIP payable monies, or once you're beyond PIP, all of that is capable, the plaintiff is capable of asserting against the tortfeasor.
That's the correct interpretation.
I believe it is, and I believe Judge Tolliver said that as well.
Okay, and to the extent that the footnote in Hearst appears to be broader than that, you're saying it's not correct.
That is what I'm saying, absolutely. Because
now,
if you
mean that Judge Tolliver recognized in this case in any way include PIP benefits. It was about $70,000, right?
I did not handle that aspect of the case, but it's not an issue that appellant brought on appeal, so I'm going to assume not.
So you don't know what the $70,000?
I do not know, no. Okay. But I think if you
should
took...
Should we know that?
Depending upon what the court wants, I can certainly inform the court of that. Yes.
Well, if we read that footnote the way in Hearst, the way you're asking us to read it, don't we have to know that?
I think you do. And I think opposing counsel can tell you he handled it with a separate workers' compensation attorney. And I was not part of that.
Well, Mr. McKinney, was the argument made to Judge Tolliver that PIP payments, whatever they may be, would not be included in the lien?
No, Justice Jacobs.
No such argument was made.
No such argument was made. No. Justice Ridgely asked what opposing counsel, what's wrong with it is a distinction between employer paid and employee paid, and a discussion of the Adams case was had. Adams is a narrow carve-out that this court made because the plaintiff in that case had purchased his own UIM coverage. The rationale that the court engaged in was a good one, but it's limited, and it should stay limited insofar as if you have an employer and an injured employee who has bought for he and his family their own underinsured or uninsured motorist coverage. They're injured at work compensation benefits are paid An employer can't turn to the employee and say, well, I've paid you workers' compensation benefits. I'm now going to grab a personal asset of yours, your underinsured motorist coverage, or your car. So obviously, in the Adams case, the rationale of the court was to protect personal assets that had been purchased, you know, who knows, for a variety of reasons. A family purchases insurance, to leave those alone. But we don't have this case here. And when Justice Ridgely asked Mr. Nishi, what's the distinction, what difference could it possibly make, I would ask the court to consider this. If the court upholds that exclusionary language in the uninsured motorist case, what workers' compensation carrier is going to write work comp insurance for a company that has vehicles and puts employees in vehicles when they have that language in? They're going to say, hey, sorry, go find another carrier. No one's going to write the insurance. Why would they? Actuarially, they figure out what these premiums are, and now, all across the state of Delaware, they're going to say, hey, you know what? I'm not writing insurance. If that U or UM or UIM provision is in there, go find another carrier. Of course, there wouldn't be another carrier because nobody would do it. I think it's got a huge impact on business going forward. And the fact of the matter is, the employer has the right to manage his money, to assume his risks, to negotiate with his carriers, and things such as this. This would...
So you're saying there's another purpose that the legislature had other than preventing a double recovery? It's basically to promote the writing of workers' compensation lines of insurance?
No, Justice Risley, no. I don't want to read that into the intention of the legislature. I'm simply picking up on a line of inquiry that you had with opposing counsel and suggesting that it may be a proper consideration for the court to think, right, going forward, what would this ruling do?
Okay, well, let's try it from this angle. What is the public policy that's served by allowing a workers' comp lien against a recovery?
Against an employer-paid recovery such as we have here?
Right. Or in any case, whenever a lien is recoverable, what's the policy that's served by that?
Well, the policy that's served by that is the long-held public policy, which would preclude double recovery of an injured worker. If you've got an injured worker who then gets all of his medical bills paid, all of his wages paid, and then has all of this available, he's got a double recovery. And the Harris case, which Mr. Nishi wishes you would overturn, the Harris case talks about that. Harris versus Newcastle County.
Well,
is...
before you get to Harris, let's just follow this through.
Okay.
How does that policy play out in the case of an employee acquired UIM coverage or UM coverage, and then secondarily in this case, where the employer acquires the coverage?
Well, as mentioned earlier, I think in the employee paid situation, you have the court not wishing to jeopardize or put in play personal assets. If I understand your question.
Well, is there a double recovery?
Yes.
If a lien is allowed in the case where the employee, the injured employee, you know, buys that coverage, the
yes.
UIM coverage.
Yes, there is. And I think the sole purpose, as I read Adams, the sole purpose that was allowed was because you can't get around it any other way. You're either saying, all right, there's a double recovery, even though the law of Delaware is long and loud against double recoveries. But what are we going to do? Here we've got a fellow that bought an insurance policy for he and his family. He's hurt on the job. He gets comp benefits. We're not going to have the employer reach into the grab bag of his personal assets and say, hey, I've got a lien I need to recover. What do you have? You've got a UM policy. That's good. You have a house. You have a car. And I think that that was the rationale. And I think, as I said earlier, it needs to, you know, I don't have a problem with it.
The rationale would be, no, there's no double recovery because this is an asset that was paid for out by the employee himself.
Well, he would get his workers' compensation benefits. And under Adams, they would not be allowed to subrogate against his personal UIM policy. And so then, I think the argument could be made there is a double recovery in that case.
And what about this case?
There is no double recovery in this case.
Because?
Well, it depending upon how the court rules, because you've got a situation where the plaintiff has received his death benefits in this case. Normally, it's medical bills and wages.
Let's assume it's not a death case.
So. Okay. Then it's medical bills and wages. So he gets them. Okay. He also then has a lien against the tortfeasor's liability, or he has a claim because it was caused by the negligence of a third person against the tortfeasor's liability policy and any underinsured motorist policy that may be applicable. So he's got that claim. He pursues that claim under 2363E, as it's always been written. However, the law says, yes, you can get the proceeds of that claim, but you can't get both. You can't get your benefits paid and your medical bills paid and then put them into evidence over here and get them paid again. What we're going to do is we're going to allow the workers' compensation carrier to come in first and be reimbursed out of that tortfeasor's liability policy or the underinsured motorist policy, whichever one it is. And then they get reimbursed and you get the rest.
I'm confused. It seems to me there's a double recovery in both cases. Is this?
He's not double recovering his medical bills and his wages. Those are being taken by the workers' compensation because of their lien under 2363E. He's not allowed to get a double recovery for his medical bills and his wages.
But he can if he acquires the insurance himself.
Under Adams, if he acquires insurance by himself, he can. And again, I think the only rationale for that, because it's in derogation of existing Delaware law that prohibits double recovery, is the court had a problem.
Well, if just hypothetically, if instead of the injured party acquiring insurance under Adams, some third party does it for him, uncle, aunt, whatever, going to help you out, buy you some insurance, would that be allowed? And where I'm leading to is,
I think
if somebody
would
volunteers to get this insurance for him, why shouldn't the same result in Adams follow through? And whether it's a grandparent or a parent or the employer.
I think under Adams, as I read Adams, I think the rationale the court reached under would reach under your hypothetical, Justice Brisley, would be the same under Adams, insofar as you've got an individual that has purchased for whoever, himself, his family, his niece, his nephew, an asset. Insurance is an asset. And I think because the workers' compensation carrier paid benefits, I don't think the court would allow them to go and reach the assets of the uncle who bought the insurance.
Well, you've got the same volunteer with the employer. The employer is, I'm going to volunteer. Well, let's say the employer is a relative who employed the person in the business, and they buy it. Why shouldn't that?
I think if the employer is a relative, the court would have to make a determination as to what role he's in when it decides the case, or I think if you're getting a paycheck and this guy's withholding your taxes and he's providing you workers' compensation coverage, I don't think it matters whether he's your nephew. I think he's your employee for those purposes. But I mean, what would the difference be? I think the difference is vast.
Can I cut you off for
sure.
A minute, because I think I'm asking the same thing but in a different way. The employer here has both workers' compensation insurance, right? And UIM or UM insurance. Two different coverages, right?
Two different coverages, two different companies.
Okay, fine. And there's a third party involved who, let's assume for the moment, actually had assets, actually had an insurance policy, which I gather was not the case here, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So why doesn't the way it works is that the worker gets his workers' compensation benefits, gets the benefit of the UIM coverage that the employer just happened to have and he happened to be driving in that car, and the employer gets to recover, or the employer's insurance company gets to recover for the workers' compensation benefits from the third party. In this case, that means you get nothing. But the point is that that is the resource that you're supposed to go to as the employer to recover the workers' compensation benefits.
Well, that result would be in direct contradiction to Harris and Lane and to the entire line of cases that that this court has established. The court and the statute didn't change in any meaningful way from the Harris decision up until now. Appellant would have you believe that it did, but it didn't in fact. The phrase used in Harris was any recovery. And the court in Harris said, we construe that to be UM benefits, UIM benefits. We treat them as if they were the liability policy of the tortfeasor. And that's what UIM insurance is. It's a replacement for the liability policy of the tortfeasor. And the court said, you know, talking about uninsured motorist car, represents the damages the third-party tortfeasor would be required to pay upon adjudication of guilt in a tort action, but for his lack of insurance.
Thank you. Your time is up.
I thank you, Your Honor.
Just briefly, in response, Your Honors, I think it's important to note that in Title 2363E, there is no distinction as to who pays the premium and whether it's employee paid and employer paid. And Your Honors asked Mr. McKenty lots of questions about whether or not there's a double recovery. Please make no mistake about it. There clearly is no double recovery in a case where my client is getting $600-some per week for her dead husband, who's making $70-some a year. There's no conscious pain and suffering permitted. There's no mental anguish claim under the workers' compensation law. There's no double recovery if she just gets comp and she's trying to make a UM claim. The purposes of those coverages are different, which is one of the reasons why this court has been such a strong advocate for those people that have the right to make an uninsured motorist claim or an uninsured motorist claim.
Can you clarify whether any of the amount of the lien allowed by the Superior Court was for personal injury protection benefits?
Your Honor, my understanding is that my client had virtually no medical expenses. And I believe that there was a minimum PIP policy, and that minimum PIP policy was paid. And the balance of the workers' compensation lien is for ongoing wrongful death benefits that were paid to my client. So to answer the court's question, the maximum amount of that lien is $15,000 eligible for PIP coverage, and certainly no more than that, because my client's getting ongoing death benefits. And there's nothing in the statute that permits that. So the PIP coverage was exhausted. My recollection is it was $15,000. But in terms of the additional questions that the court asked, if the court looks at pages 13 and 14 of our opening brief, there are, as I count, decisions from nine states that specifically indicate that there is no workers' compensation lien for employer-paid UM coverage. And I'll submit to you that in the Adams case, if the court
statutory languages like Delaware,
very similar, Your Honor. And in fact, the provisions that I mentioned to you, the reasons why those provisions were upheld. The reasons, the policy reasons, are those five reasons set forth in pages 13 and 14 of our brief, and they're in footnote 25 of the cases. And in fact, as this court has...
But we would have to overrule Harris?
Well, Your Honor, I think you need to overrule Harris in that. There's a few reasons for that. One is the footnote, which it, I'll submit to you. And that was an en banc decision. It was a carefully written and extremely important decision for this state. It clearly says what it says. The second significant thing is that in the Adams case...
So you are asking us to overrule Harris?
I think the court is either going to have to overrule Adams or they're going to have to overrule Harris. Because the court can't get to the question of whether or not, why does the purpose of 2363 change whether you paid for it or not? There's nothing in the statute that says that. And if the court looks at it, and you're hypothetical, if you're in my car, and we're not relatives, and someone runs a red light who's uninsured, you get the benefit of my coverage. Is it luck? Did you pay for it? Did you earn it? No. But uninsured motorist coverage also follows the vehicle and it follows the person. So you would have access to my insurance, and you didn't pay a dime for that coverage. And it's sort of the risk of the road. And if Mr. McKinney is right, if the sky has fallen, well, why in at least eight or nine other states have insurance companies not fled the borders because of this fear that all of a sudden the premiums are going to go through the roof? This is an unusual case, but it's an important case because of the distinction set forth in our briefs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement, and the court is adjourned.